This is the Living Homegrown Podcast, episode 159.
Welcome to the Living Homegrown Podcast, where it's all about how to live farm fresh without the farm. To help guide the way to a more flavorful and sustainable lifestyle is your host, national PBS TV producer and canning expert, Teresa Lowe.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Lowe, and this podcast is where we talk about living farm fresh without a farm. Now, that includes organic small space food gardening and artisan food crafts like canning, fermenting, and even baking your own bread. It's all about the different ways that we can live closer to our food and take small, delicious steps toward living a more sustainable lifestyle. If you want to learn more about any of these topics or my farm fresh courses, my online business coaching, or my Living Homegrown membership, just visit my website, livinghomegrown.com. On today's episode, we're going to talk about the science that we can use to make ourselves better gardeners. I'm really excited about this episode because I truly do believe that in anything that we do, if we understand the reasons behind some of the techniques, it makes it easier to troubleshoot things and it makes it easier for us to apply new strategies when we understand what's really going on. And to help us do that today, I brought back Dr. Lee Reich. Now, Lee has been on the episode before. He was on an episode where we talked all about blueberries, and I will link to that in the show notes. It was one of my most popular episodes when it came to growing food because everyone always gets stuck when they're growing blueberries, and Lee was able to give us some really solid information to tell us what we can do to make our blueberries even better. Well, he's doing the same thing today, but he's diving into all different aspects of growing food and even how we can get better flavor from what we grow. So some of the things that we're going to talk about in today's show, so we're going to talk about ripening tomatoes, how to speed that up, what it does when we do speed it up. We're going to talk about bagging fruit. We're going to talk about soil and organic matter and all the benefits and reasons and different things that are happening in that soil when we add organic matter. And we're even going to bust a few myths today on today's episode. And lastly, we're going to dive into some tips for storing any seeds that you might be collecting over the next couple of months as you're shutting down your garden. So I really am excited about this. Lee has a tremendous academic background, and yet he can explain the science to us in really easy to understand ways. And that's why I love having him on the show. It's a fascinating thing to talk to him. I always learn so much. So let me tell you a little bit about Lee before we get started. Dr. Lee Reich dove into gardening over 40 years ago, initially with one foot in academia as an agricultural scientist with the USDA and Cornell University, and one foot in the field, the organic field. He eventually expanded his field to a farmden. That's what he calls his property, which is more than a garden and less than a farm. And he left academia to lecture, consult, and write. And thank goodness he did. Lee is the author of several books: A Northeast Gardener's Year, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden, The Pruning Book, Weedless Gardening, Landscaping with Fruit, Growing Fruit Naturally, and most recently, his latest book is called The Ever Curious Gardener, and I'm going to talk about that one in just a second. Lee also has a syndicated column for Associated Press that appears bi-monthly in newspapers from coast to coast. His farmden has been featured in numerous magazines, including Martha Stewart Living and even the New York Times. Besides providing a year-round supply of fruits and vegetables, the farmden has an educational mission, and it is a test site for innovative techniques in soil care, pruning, and food production. Science and an appreciation of natural systems underpin all of Lee's work. His goal is to help more people, whether in their backyards or small farms, to grow more food sustainably and organically. Now, I want to talk to you about his latest book because that is really why I wanted to bring Lee on. I got a copy of this book and I love it. It's a fascinating read. It's an easy read. And yet I felt like I had just learned so much that I practically had a degree in horticulture when I was done. It was just absolutely fascinating. The name of the book is The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Now, what Lee has done here with this book is he has basically used his backyard as a laboratory, and he has been studying and testing and doing all sorts of research on what works and what doesn't. And then he also backs up everything that he has done with more research. So it's just fascinating, some of the things that maybe we think we, you know, we do, we don't have any reason why we do it. He explains the reasons that we're doing things and why things work and why things don't. But he also busts down some of the myths of things that we may have just been doing for a long time and are actually counterproductive. So it covers everything from flowering and fruiting and stems and leaves and the effects of stress on our plants to our soil and what we can do and not do to make our soil better, even how to make our food taste better when we're gardening. So that's why I was so excited to have Lee on, because I just wanted to dive into a little bit of everything, which is what we did. Now, as always, I will have links in the show notes to everything that we talk about with Lee, including all of his books. And to get to the show notes, you just go to livinghomegrown.com/159, and everything will be right there for you. Now, before we dive into the interview, I want you to know that today's podcast episode is brought to you by my Living Homegrown Institute, which is my monthly membership site where you get access to an entire library of monthly masterclasses to help you live farm fresh without the farm. In my membership, we cover everything from how to grow heirloom tomatoes to raising chickens and even making your own homemade cheese, yogurt, and fermented vegetables. Now, I believe that living an organic farm fresh lifestyle is really just a journey in learning. And just as we learn different skills such as food fermentation or food growing, we also have three distinct stages of growth. We start out being curious, we move into experimentation, and eventually we grow into mastery of some of these different skills. Now, if you're looking at creating a farm fresh lifestyle for yourself and you're curious where you fall on the growth scale with any of these skills, I have a free resource for you. It's called my Farm Fresh Success Path that my students use inside my Learning Institute. And it will help you decide where you are on your own journey, the characteristics of that stage, and some action steps and information to take you to the next level. To get a copy of the Success Path PDF, just go to livinghomegrown.com/path, that's P-A-T-H, and you can download it there for free. Okay, so let's dive into our interview with Dr. Lee Reich, the author of The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Hey, Lee, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
It's great to be here again.
Oh, good. Well, I was so absolutely thrilled with getting a copy of your new book. It was a fascinating read, and I'm recommending it already to all my gardener friends. So I'm really excited to share it with my listeners, because I really do feel that if we can understand why things are going on in our garden, it makes us better gardeners. So thank you so much for writing this book.
You can't see me, but I'm blushing.
Good. Well, I'd love to, first of all, just dive in really quickly into what made you decide to write this particular book.
So as I say in the introduction to my book, I have somewhat of a unique background in gardening. I did not come from a farm background or even a gardening background, hardly. But I did, at some age, when I was in my 20s, all of a sudden decide that I really wanted to get interested in gardening, or really wanted to dive into gardening. And the way I dove into gardening was I went to graduate school in agriculture, and I started a garden at the same time. And I was in heaven, because I didn't know anything about gardening or soils or horticulture. And every day I'd be learning so much, and then I'd go home and I was gardening like a maniac. And I also had access to a really good agricultural library. So I'd read everything I could read. And so I went from there. So I have a strong academic background, but also I still garden as crazily as I did when I started. And then one day I was making compost. And as I was adding, I really like to make compost. It's one of my favorite things. Some people think I have a garden just to do something with my compost. So one day, as I was building my compost pile, and I was, you know, adding materials, you know, thoughtfully and sort of patting them down and watering it a certain way, and I was thinking how everything I was doing, even though I've done it for a long time, but it really spoke to a lot of what I learned in graduate school about soil. One of my graduate degrees is in soil science. So really that sort of guided what I was doing semi-consciously, sort of consciously and subconsciously. And I was thinking how I do make really good compost. It's been tested many times. And I was thinking one reason my compost is so good is because I have that sort of science underpinning. Making compost isn't all science because there's a lot of variables. There's also a certain amount of art to it, but you know, you put it all together. And so I definitely thought that this science was a big help. And then I started thinking about a lot of other stuff I do in the garden also sort of reflects what I learned not only when I was in school, but also reading research journals and also speaking with a lot of other gardeners, farmers, scientists, and a lot of experience. I've made compost for decades and garden for decades. So I just began to really appreciate the science behind it all. And I was thinking if I could sort of convey some of that science to other gardeners, they could also not only have a better garden, but I think it also makes a gardener more resilient. For instance, changing climate conditions, or even if a gardener, if you happen to have a new site that you're gardening at, you know, if you garden in one place for say 10 years and then all of a sudden you move somewhere, if you know something about the science that's going on behind the garden, this can actually help you garden better at the new site because what you did at the old site might not work at the new site. And then finally, I thought that knowing some of the science, it just makes gardening more interesting. I mean, I find gardening interesting, but just knowing what's going on makes it really just more fascinating. It's never boring. And I think that's one reason why I'm still so crazy about gardening, because every year I'm like learning things new and discovering new things.
I absolutely agree with you. It is, I love what you say, it's a blending of science and art. So much of what we do is that. But I loved, I think, the way you approach this book, because with all your background and your academia, you could very easily talk over all of our heads and we wouldn't understand what you were saying. But instead, you really brought this down to a really practical level and made it very easy for any of us to just dive right into understanding what's really happening. And that you're absolutely right. Like if you understand what's happening, then you can make judgments or make judgment calls anytime during the season when something comes up, because you have a better grasp as to, instead of just guessing and throwing something out there and trying to make it work. So I love one of the sections that you had in your book about ethylene and ripening tomatoes. And I'd love to start there since we're recording this in August and so many people are harvesting their tomatoes right now. So could you explain about the key role that ethylene plays in ripening a tomato?
Well, I think ethylene, first of all, is really fascinating generally because ethylene is a plant hormone. And just like humans have hormones, other animals have hormones, plants also have hormones. And hormones are generally really complicated compounds, whereas ethylene, which is a plant hormone, is very simple. It's two atoms of carbon and two atoms of hydrogen. So it's a simple compound. And furthermore, it's a gas, which also seems sort of odd or unique to me. Ethylene has effects on plants in a lot of different ways, and one way it has an effect is in it speeds up ripening. And so basically, different types of fruits can be affected differently by ethylene. There's basically two categories of fruits. There's what are called climacteric fruits and non-climacteric fruits. And tomato is a climacteric fruit, and when exposed to ethylene, its ripening speeds up a lot. So a practical application of this is, for instance, people sometimes, especially towards the end of the season, when outdoor ripening conditions aren't that good, they might put tomatoes on their windowsill to speed up ripening. Mm-hmm. Actually, putting them on the windowsill doesn't speed up ripening because light has nothing to do with it. It's really ethylene. So not only does ethylene speed ripening of tomatoes, but ripening tomatoes give off ethylene. So if you wanted to speed up ripening, if you put tomatoes, say, in a bag where the ethylene does not dissipate as much and you get ethylene built up in the bag, they'll ripen faster. And this is why maybe sometimes people wrap them, maybe not knowing this is why they do it, but say wrap individual tomatoes in newspaper or something like that. And then this speeds up the ripening. And one fruit can speed ripening up another. Sometimes people put, say, an apple into a bag with bananas, and then the apple gives off ethylene and speeds up banana ripening. And ethylene has so many hormones. Ethylene has other effects depending on when and how much is applied. For instance, ethylene can also induce flowering and fruiting in plants. hormones typically do not have just one effect. But the thing with speeding up ripening is a very interesting one. You know, there's a saying that one bad apple spoils the barrel.
Yes.
That's 100% true. And the reason for it is because when a fruit is damaged, damage also induces ethylene. So if you have a whole barrel of apples and one of the apples is damaged, that gives off a lot of ethylene. And apples are also climacteric fruits whose ripening is speeded up by ethylene. Mm-hmm. So you have one bad apple in the barrel, and the apple ripening is very speeded up, so the apples get overripe and presumably spoiled faster than they would normally.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, so whenever I harvest my apples, I'm always very careful not to have any dings, and I knew that having dings would make that one go faster, but now that makes perfect sense why that can ruin the whole batch. Yes.
Yeah, and often if you look at an apple, say, with a ding in it, there'll be a sort of a speeded up ripening right near the ding even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it'll be a little redder right there.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Ah, that makes perfect sense. So it does have to do with the ethylene. That's fascinating. So I know when you pick all your tomatoes, don't you store them like down in the basement? Do you just check them every couple days? What do you do?
Well, in all honesty, I used to do that. Now I have a greenhouse, so I don't
you cheat.
Do that often. But what I used to do is, yes, I would just put them in the basement. They didn't have to be, but I didn't want to speed up ripening too much because I was trying to extend the season by just having them ripen slowly in the basement. But they did ripen faster than, say, outdoor tomatoes where cold weather probably slowed them down. And then I think in those days I used to use my oil burner more, which is in the basement. Mm. And any type of burning gives off ethylene also. So maybe a little ethylene drifted from the oil burner. You know, just trace amounts are needed, very small amounts.
Wow.
So that could have also affected ripening.
Okay. Well, now what about the difference? Like, okay, we all talk about if we have a vine ripened tomato, that it will taste better than something perhaps that was picked a little underripe and allowed to ripen on the shelf. Have you noticed that that's true?
Actually, I don't think that's totally true. First of all, a tomato will be ripened by ethylene, but it has to be a certain degree of maturity before it can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if it's just about ready to ripen and be ready to be picked, then you pick it and then it ripens off the plant, I think the flavor would be pretty much the same. If you pick it, you know, a little too much before that, then the flavor, I definitely think, would be different. And, you know, this sort of touches on another topic. This is one of my pet peeves. People often, they buy, say, hard plums at a supermarket and they say they're just going to leave them out to ripen a little. So not all fruits will ripen off a plant. Generally, although not always, climacteric fruits like bananas, pears, apples, tomatoes will ripen off a plant and will ripen to good quality if they're picked sufficiently mature.
Mm-hmm.
But some fruits won't ripen at all once they're picked. So if you pick a plum and let it sit on a counter, I like to call it incipient rot. So the fruit will soften.
Yes.
And actually any carbohydrates, you know, starches in the fruit could actually change to sugar as, you know, bacteria and fungi break them down. They could actually get a little sweeter. But there's a world of difference between, you know, the flavor components of a fruit that's showing incipient rot and actually ripening.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too appetizing. Absolutely.
Right, right.
But no, I know what you mean. Like there's layers of flavor when it's been on the tree. We do have a plum tree. Yeah. And when I pick them too soon, it's night and day. It's like it's a different fruit.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not supposed to taste like lemons.
Yeah, true. That's so true. Yeah. Well, now what about sunlight in enhancing the flavor of fruit? Like when I prune my apple trees, I'm always opening up the canopy so that sunlight hits the apples. And it does seem to enhance the flavor versus if I just let my apple trees run amok and they get really overgrown.
Well, one thing that sunlight definitely does with apples is it helps apples turn red. In Japan, they like to bag apples. They like pale apples.
Oh.
So they actually bag them so light doesn't hit the fruit and they don't turn that red. And I do agree, and I have to admit that I'm not 100% sure that this has been documented, but I do agree that it seems to me that the flavor is enhanced by light falling directly on the fruit.
Okay.
So a lot of times commercially people do that, surely for turning the fruit color, but I think it affects flavor too. And also, once again, not all fruits are the same. Some fruits, their color at least, is not affected at all by sunlight.
Okay. But apples, it is.
One fruit that's not affected is grapes. grapes will turn color whether or not they get sunlight. And this sort of relates to bagging grapes, which I do to my grapes. Mm-hmm. I bag not every grape bunch just because I have too many grapes, but I bag about 100 bunches every season. And that's only because to keep insects, including bees, off the fruit, birds, diseases, and it just makes for perfect bunches. The fruit will turn color. It does not need light.
Okay.
So the fruit colors up. Speaking to a grape researcher, so it seems like this would be true, contended that the flavor also is improved by light falling directly on the grapes. But my grapes, as I said, don't get light. And the flavor, I have to say, is, not to use that overused word, but awesome.
Okay. Now, so when you do this with the bagging of fruit, I've done something similar with a peach tree, and I've experimented with apple trees where I'm bagging the fruit just to see what would happen, but I haven't done it in such large quantities as you have. But when you're bagging, let's say, your grapes, what sort of bags are you using?
I just bought like 1,000 delicatessen bags a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
On the outside of the bag, I think it says delicious baked goods. And I figure that throws the birds and the insects off.
They'll go the other way.
No grapes in there.
Yeah, yeah, they'll never know.
So I just use those kind of bags just because they have a slight coating on them so they last a little longer.
Okay.
But, you know, you could also use paper bags, I guess, depending on how much, you know, rainfall you get.
Okay.
But it really is amazing, the quality. And mostly because where I grow my plants, where I live, there's a lot of grape disease problems. And so if they're not bagged in some years, such as this year, we've had continual rainfall, you know, there'd just be so much disease that, you know, every bunch will have a lot of rotten berries, if there's a bunch at all, versus the bagged ones. It'll be like you open it up and in the ideal world, you get this perfect bunch of grapes. In the real world, I have to admit that sometimes I'll tear open a bag and there'll be nothing in there.
Oh, no.
I've worked a little with the timing and everything, and I'm not sure what the effect is because just sometimes there's nothing in there.
How funny.
It doesn't seem related to any timing.
Ah, okay. So what about flavor, though? Do you think being bagged, do you think it enhances or just doesn't have any effect on flavor?
I think it doesn't have any effect, but where I am, if I let the fruit hang on the vine that long, first of all, as I said, it gets exposed to insects and diseases.
Mm.
And so that could influence the flavor. So, the flavor could also be influenced by not getting any pest problems. As a matter of practicality, if I leave it that long, birds start pecking and bees start going for them. So, you know, I probably can't let them get as ripe because the fruit that I bag, you know, I've looked up maturity dates that are given by Cornell, which has the same climate as I do, for various varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll often go 2 weeks longer than that because grapes will keep for a long time, you know, quite a while after their stated maturity date. And the flavor just keeps up to a point. The flavor just keeps getting better and better.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. I'd love to shift gears and talk about soil because you did a whole section on soil, which was absolutely fascinating. But you talk a lot about organic matter, which, you know, any good gardener loves organic matter, and especially if you love to do composting. And I loved what you were talking about, the different benefits of organic matter. And I have a lot of new gardeners, and I have a lot of experienced gardeners who listen to the show. So let's talk a little bit about organic matter. First of all, I guess I should have you define what organic matter is.
Yeah, so organic matter is anything that is or was living. So it could be things like, you know, straw, it could be compost, it could be sawdust, pine needles, leaves, anything, weeds, dead weeds, or it could be live weeds, you know, cover crops. So organic matter is anything that is or was living. And manure, because that's, you know, a lot of bacteria and fungi in there. So there's raw organic matter, which would be things like fresh leaves, and straw and, say, vegetable trimmings, things like that. And then once it's piled up, say, in a compost pile or added to the soil, it starts to decompose, and then it becomes what you could call soil organic matter or compost if it's in a separate compost pile. And there's a number of changes that occur as it decomposes, basically bacteria and fungi and other microorganisms chew away at it, and all sorts of compounds are produced. It's really just becomes a witch's brew of both known and unknown substances. people generally like to have complicated formulas for, you know, if you do this in the garden, you know, yields will be increased or the flavor of everything would be increased. And, you know, I hate to, well, I actually like to simplify things. But I would say if you just continually enrich your soil with plenty of organic, some sort of, or many sorts of organic materials, that you're 90% of the way there to being a great gardener.
And you can't add too much, right? You can just keep adding to it. I mean, you might add too much of one particular thing. You could put something out of balance, but organic matter in general, we can't add too much.
I've said that many times, and tempering it just a little,
okay.
And I could just segue into that for a second. So typically a soil will be less than 5% organic matter. So this is the amount, you know, when organic, fresh organic materials have decomposed and they've been incorporated into the soil, this would be what this percentage represents. So usually soils are just a few percent organic matter. The rich prairie soils might be 6% organic matter. So my garden, I've added a lot of compost every year, and I don't till the soil, so the organic matter doesn't decompose. What happens, even organic matter that's in the soil continues to decompose even after it's broken down at a slow rate. First, there's an initial flush of decomposition, and then it continues forever at a very slow rate. So over time, organic matter can just disappear. It will disappear. And tilling a soil by adding a lot of oxygen to the soil really sort of gives bacteria and fungi this extra oomph and speeds decomposition. So it's harder to maintain organic matter levels in the soil. So that was all just to say that I have not tilled my soil for many decades. And I add a lot of compost. So my organic matter levels are very high. They're about 15%.
Wow.
And so what was your question?
So the question was, can we add too much?
Oh, yeah. So I often wondered, you know, the soil feels good, everything looks good, and everything grows well in it. Can you add too much? So it turns out when you add a lot of organic materials, these tend to be rich in phosphorus and potassium, which are plant nutrients. So the question is, can you have too much of either of these things? And generally, potassium, there's really no concern, and excess will just wash out of the soil eventually. And phosphorus was always thought to be tied up in the soil. It precipitates because it reacts with other things in the soil, mm-hmm. and then precipitates into something that really becomes just slowly resolubilized. So I figured that phosphorus was okay also. And then more recently, they've found that if you have enough phosphorus in a soil, it can actually start leaching out, being washed into the groundwater, which is not a good thing. And one reason they started looking at this is because typically on farms, you know, regular farms, not necessarily organic farms, a lot of phosphorus fertilizer is added. And the reason a lot's added is because it is precipitated. So you got to add a lot because a lot of it's just going to become unavailable. But so much has been added over so many years that now it is starting to leach out and maybe plants take up a lot. So this is something I'm interested in. And I'm going to be following up with some researchers from University of Vermont who are looking at the groundwater to see how much actually gets there. I was actually going to bore some holes myself and see how much phosphorus was in my groundwater. My groundwater level is very high, so it's not. I don't have to go that deep.
That was my next question. Was like, how far do you have to go?
It's only 10 feet deep.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
And sometimes it's only 3 feet deep.
Wow.
But then also I recently had tissue test, which means you test the leaves of a plant to see if, you know, how. One thing is to do a soil test to see what's in the soil. A tissue test sees what plants actually took up. So I thought a tissue test would be interesting, see how phosphorus and potassium levels were. And it turns out they were both in the normal range, you know, a little high in the normal range, but nothing of concern. So I guess I'm still standing by you can't add too much organic matter, but I'm looking into this further.
Okay. Yeah, just to make, like, probably the average person, because they may not have an area where they haven't tilled in decades, and you're so scientific right about everything else. So, you know, an average gardener probably couldn't add too much. I could see how in your situation, though, maybe with already having 15%, that's incredible. I can't believe it.
Right. You have to be a little crazed to add that much.
Yeah. But still, even with that, so far, you don't see anything. So that's a good sign.
No, Yeah. And also just working the soil, you know, so that gets back to your question about, you know, so there's many benefits of organic matter in all respects. And one benefit is obviously the nutritional benefit, because the organic matter actually helps feed plants. And it does this in a number of ways. One way is, as it slowly decomposes, it releases nutrients that plants can take up. Mm-hmm. Another way is that it releases acids and other compounds that actually help release nutrients from the rocks that make up the soil, you know, rocks that are broken down to very small particles. They actually are a source of nutrients, and especially so when you have organic matter helping that along. And then the third way organic matter helps is this is a real promo for organic matter.
Yeah, it is. It's like a commercial.
Right. And the third way organic matter will help feed your soil is it has these compounds called chelating compounds. So some nutrients that are in the soil, plants might not be able to take up. And by these chelating compounds or organic compounds that form around different mineral nutrients that actually help plants take up the nutrients. So three ways.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And that's just a nutritional benefit.
So also that just means that by adding it, anything else that's in the soil becomes more available, because it's in different ways, in different actions, things that it's not just what the organic matter is that you're adding, but it has an effect on the soil to release other nutrients to the plants.
Right. And the organic matter itself has nutrients in
right.
it too.
Right. Okay.
I mean, So much so that typically if people use, you know, a reasonable amount of organic matter adding to the soil every year, and that's the important thing, is you don't just add it once and that's that, because it's always decomposing. Mm-hmm. But typically if you do that, the only nutrient that might be lacking is the nutrient that plants need in greatest amounts, and that would be nitrogen. So I used to add a source of nitrogen in addition to the compost. And then every year I'd make these calculations that for this amount of organic matter I'm adding, which would be compost, is what I add to my vegetable garden, which, you know, vegetables need a lot of food, especially when intensively grown. So I made this calculation that kept telling me that this amount of compost that I'm adding should be enough to feed plants for a year. So I actually stopped adding any other fertilizers. So the only thing my vegetables get, and very intensively planted, the only thing they get is a 1-inch depth of compost every year. And that's it. That's all the feed they get, and it feeds them.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. And as an organic gardener, that's what we want to do. My listeners don't want to use any chemicals. They want to use everything natural. And that's the most natural way you can feed. Like they say, feed the soil, and that's how you feed the plants.
Right. Yeah. Right. Not only is it, you know, so-called natural way to feed, but it's also more sustainable, because everything that goes into my compost would otherwise be a waste product. It's like old garden plants. There's a horse farm nearby that I get horse manure, and that's a big problem. They have all this waste horse manure that they have to get rid of. So I'm helping them out.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're helping you out at the same time.
Yeah, so when people talk about sustainable and organic isn't always sustainable. You know, there's plenty of organic fertilizers you can buy that, you know, they take energy to make. And sometimes if you don't have the time or the means for getting enough organic materials to make compost, enough compost to feed your plants, you know, you have to do that. You know, gardening, this is the only way to do it. But, you know, you can have sort of a goal. And I do get enough compost. So going on to other benefits of the organic matter in the soil, another one is biological. So when you add these organic materials to the soil, you're really promoting growth of a myriad of micro and macro organisms. And when you have a well-made compost or a lot of organic matter in the soil, unless something very strange is going on, you have a lot of beneficial organisms that really help fight diseases and also help plants take up nutrients. There's, for instance, fungi called mycorrhizal fungi that actually infect plant roots, but it's a symbiotic infection where the fungi put their hyphae into the plant roots. These are thin threads of what make up the fungi, and they actually take some of the carbohydrates that plants make through sunlight, but in return, they act like extensions of the root system and help plants take up both nutrients and water.
Wow.
So that's just one example of, and then, you know, there's all sorts of known and unknown interactions in the soil like that. So that's another benefit. And the third benefit of these organic materials is basically just physical in the soil. They help aerate a soil, and they also help soils hold moisture. So that's two things. Obviously, it's like two opposing things, it would seem, because usually soils that are very wet don't have a lot of room for air in them. But if the soil particles are aggregated into larger units, then in between those large units is large spaces. And in these aggregates, there's small spaces that can hold capillary water. And then the organic matter itself is sort of like a sponge, which can also hold water. So you get the best of all worlds.
Yeah.
So that's my case for organic matter.
It's a good case. But no, absolutely. That's the whole point, is it brings all of this together. It does everything that we need, makes less work for us, and makes everything easier for the plant. So I think you sold your case. I think that was an excellent commercial.
And as far as organic matter, those of you that, you know, any listeners that are consider themselves to be organic gardeners, organic matter is what put the organic in the phrase organic gardening. So it's always been sort of the linchpin of organic gardening is, you know, plenty of organic matter.
Yes, it's like the key to everything. Yeah, if you have that, then you're on the right road and you're heading the right direction.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, something else I wanted to touch on that can kind of step off of this when we're talking about soil and, you know, having moisture and even drainage. There's something that we've focused on before on Growing a Greener World, and that is drainage, where people think they should put rocks or stones or things like that in the bottom of their flower pots for good drainage. And it actually has the opposite effect. And you do talk about that in the book. And I love the way you explained it, because it really is counterintuitive. You think, well, I'll just put stones in the bottom of the pot, and then that way the water will drain right out. But actually the opposite happens. So could you talk to us about that?
Right. This is another one of my pet peeves. I should say that I was first introduced to this concept when I was in graduate school. There was a movie made from Washington State University that you can actually find on the internet. It's a movie from 1961. It's sort of a fun movie to watch because it's very dated, because there's two men that demonstrate this effect with a lab setup, and it's very convincing. And also, but they're dressed in suits, which is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
And they're in suits of 1961 vintage, too.
How funny.
So if anybody's interested in seeing that, the movie is called, I actually bought a copy of the movie. I'm so into it. And it's called Water Movement in Soils.
Sounds really exciting.
Basically, the point is, as you said, on the edge of my chair each time I see it. But so the point of the movie is that, you know, if you had, say, clay soil and you were going to plant a tree, or you had a soil for a flower pot, a potting mix, and you wanted to make the water drain better, because basically, you know, plants like good drainage. Most people, what they would do would be put either a layer of gravel in the bottom of the flower pot, or even under, say, if you're planting a tree, if you read some old gardening books, and more recently, actually on the internet, I saw a web series of some gardener in England who shall remain nameless, but he was talking about planting lavender. Since lavender likes good drainage, that the way you do that is you dig a hole, and then you put gravel in the bottom of the hole, and then you put the soil back in. And it actually has the exact opposite effect. You know, most people intuitively would be able to figure out, say, if you had a soil that's very porous, and then you had an underlayment of clay soil, you know, the water would go quickly through the porous soil, and then since it goes very slowly into the clay, you get what's called a perched water table. So a layer of water would build up, and that wouldn't be good for plants.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out if you have a soil that doesn't drain well, or a potting soil that does drain well, but you add a layer of very coarse gravel beneath it, any other change in soil porosity that's dramatic, you even in that case get this perched water table. And that has to do with, without getting into it in too much detail, with a suction and what it takes to draw water out of the soil beyond what gravity would do. So gravity pushes water through a soil, but then when it gets to a certain place, it won't leave unless it has enough suction. And one way you could demonstrate this yourself at home very easily is if you take a big sponge and you soak it in water, and then you hold it up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So you can feel that sponge still has water in it. It's holding it by capillary attraction. So to just show how there's a layer of water right at the lower point in that sponge, if you hold the sponge so it's sort of flat in the air.
Like horizontal? You'd hold it horizontal first? Okay.
Yeah, but then you turn it so that it's still horizontal, but only one of the narrower edges is now facing the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So when you had it the other way, you had a large area, say if that large area had, say, it was holding a half an inch of water.
Mm-hmm.
So if you turn it upright and now you have just a narrower area, but that sponge is still capable of only holding a half an inch of water, but that wider area is going to add more than a half an inch of water when it's turned upright.
Yes.
So then if you turn it upright, some water will come out. Just try it, and you know, it'll be more believable as you see it. So you have it, you know, sort of flat with the biggest surface facing down, and it's saturated. You turn it upright, and then you have a narrower part facing down, and all of a sudden water comes out. It's really easier to show this than to describe it. But
yeah.
But that sponge is only capable of holding, say, a half an inch of water against gravity.
Got it.
And if that half an inch of water spread over a large area, okay, so it can hold it. But if you all of a sudden, like by tipping it up, spread whatever water was in that large area over a smaller area, it's going to be more than a half an inch. So enough water will then leave the sponge so that it's only a half an inch on that surface facing down.
Got it. Yes. Yes. So it's that.
Anyway,
it proves your point, though, that because it's hitting a difference,
right,
that's what's holding that water inside that sponge.
Right. And so this really has a lot of practical implications. One is, say, when you're planting a tree, you don't add a lot of even organic matter, which improves drainage and makes the soil more porous. You don't add pretty much anything. Ideally, you just put the soil you took out of the hole, put it back in the hole, so that there's no big difference between the soil in the hole and surrounding, because basically you don't want, otherwise you're going to get this water layer at the bottom. And furthermore, the roots won't be that inclined to leave anyway, because it'll be sort of like a pot within the soil if it's too dramatic a difference. And if it's really nice, soft, aerated soil in the planting hole, why would the roots want to leave?
Right, right. They'll think, well, this is where the good stuff is. I'll just stay right here.
Yeah, right. And then also in flower pots, the idea is you don't put anything in the bottom. You just you start out with a porous potting mix and you just put it right to the bottom of the pot.
Yes.
And there is an unavoidable perched water table at the bottom of any flower pot, because you have this dramatic change in porosity, mm-hmm, either from the soil to the non-porous bottom of the pot, or if the drainage hole could be, you know, to air, if it's just perched, you know, somewhere where it's just air in the bottom exposed. So the whole reason why you cannot take straight garden soil and put it in a pot is because the depth of that unavoidable perched water table from that change in porosity at the bottom of the pot,
mm-hmm,
is determined by the capillary attraction within that soil. And if you took straight garden soil, which is good out in a garden where you have a great depth of soil, but in a flower pot, you'll have too great a depth of perched water table, which is soil with water in it and not air, so there'll be less root depth there. So if you make a potting soil more porous, which is one thing that makes potting soils, you add extra, say, perlite or vermiculite or sand, then this makes it more porous. So you still have that perched water table, but since it doesn't have as much capillarity, it's only much more shallow. It's right at the bottom of the pot.
Yes. Yeah, so the bottom line is to just fill it with the potting soil and not put anything at the bottom, so that it's all the same all the way throughout.
Right.
And then the only place you could have the perched water table is at the bottom when you hit the bottom of the pot.
Right. Well, you'll still have a perched water table, but it'd be a very shallow one.
Right.
As opposed to if you had a straight garden soil, even good garden soil, it would be much deeper.
Got it.
So a potting soil should have some sort of aggregate to increase its porosity.
Got it. Yes. Yeah. And that's really, it is counterintuitive. You know, it makes sense when you hear it like, oh, put rocks in the bottom of your flower pot. I mean, I know when I first started gardening years and years ago,
right,
I did that. And then when I learned differently, it was like, this just doesn't sound right. But it does, from a scientific standpoint, totally make sense.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
and if you watch the movie Water Movement in Soil, it shows that they do a slow motion video of soil between two glass plates, different types of soils, and you can see the wetting front as it's moving down, what happens to it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I am going to try and find that. I mean, it only us gardeners probably would find that fascinating, but I think my kids would even find that fascinating, because it's just not what you think would happen.
Yeah.
But it does make sense. Yes.
It is slow motion, though.
Yeah, well,
but speed it up.
Yeah,
it's like, normally very slow, but it's, yeah, speed it up a little.
Yeah, you need a whole bowl of popcorn to get through that. Yeah. So one of the other things I wanted to ask you, since we're at the end of August here and a lot of people are starting to save seed, or they're going to be saving their seed. And so the last thing I wanted to talk to you about was how you save your seed, because you talked a little bit about that in the book as well, and things that you found that help and that don't help.
The packets. Say,
yes.
So they last. The things that keep seed lasting longer are cooler or colder temperatures and lower humidity to a point, the humidity. So what I started out doing is I had these plastic storage boxes, or maybe there was shoe box on them, but they sealed pretty well. And I would keep my seeds in that. And then I originally had these little silica gel packets that would keep, absorb the humidity. And of course, over time, I've had the same seed boxes for many, many years, and they've cracked, so they're no longer airtight. And the silica gel, I keep forgetting to renew, so they're not stored that well. And the problem is, in the summer, when I have my seeds are in my garage, and it's humid and hot, so that's not that great. So I was thinking that some seeds I'd like to keep longer, and the way to do it would be you can keep them in a freezer. The main problem of the freezer, when you take them out of the freezer on a humid day, you're going to get all this condensation, which will sort of add moisture, which won't be good for them. Or you could keep them. So what I would start to do is I would keep seeds, start keeping them in mason jars, the seeds that I don't have to get back to all summer. Like I plant onions once and late winter or midwinter, actually. So I could just put them in a jar, seal them up. And then I thought that maybe if I decreased the oxygen level, because basically seeds, even though they look like they're dead, they're really alive and they're undergoing respiration, breathing essentially at a very slow rate. So if you decrease the oxygen or conversely increase the carbon dioxide, this also could slow aging of the seeds. So what I did is I also found on the internet, which I'd seen many years ago, but finally got around to doing it, I reverse engineered a bicycle pump. So instead of pumping air, it was taking out air.
Ah.
And then I got one of these things that's used for, I'm trying to think what it is used for. It's used for preserving vegetables or something.
Oh, like a food
it's
saver?
It's called like a food saver.
Yeah, food saver.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
And they had one that would actually fit on top of a mason jar. So I started putting the seeds in the mason jar, put this food saver device over it, and then I sort of made it so that I could put a tube from my reversed bicycle pump and then to evacuate the air from it. And it worked pretty well. Occasionally the seal would be broken, which was sort of disappointing. But it kept pretty well. The main problem is that it's somewhat of a hassle, so I can only do it for seeds that I'm not going to keep getting back to. And the other problem is that mason jars, the seeds don't fit that easily in. So I always try and put more seeds than I should. But that worked pretty well. And then through winter, I keep them in the same garage, and so the temperatures are cold where I am. And it worked pretty well.
Yeah, that's kind of fun.
And the other thing to keep in mind is that different seeds vary in how long they innately will keep. And onion seeds, which I mentioned, are among the seeds that keep the shortest amount of time. So I was trying to preserve them because I never use a whole packet of onion seeds. So I was thinking, if I could keep them, then I could use them for a few years.
Yeah, very true. Onion seeds go pretty quickly. So that gives you a way to extend them for longer than 1 year, which is fantastic. So yeah, I found that really curious. And I loved your whole reverse engineering thing and pumping out the air, which makes, a lot of sense. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah. Well, and the important thing also is just to realize that seeds are alive. Even I'm always amazed, even though I've, used seeds for so many years, plant seeds, I'm just always amazed how these lifeless appearing little specks and bigger specks can actually grow into, a corn seed grows into this giant plant, a tomato seeds, the plants are 8 feet tall now. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. Like all of that genetics is in that tiny, tiny little seed. It's just amazing. Yeah. Well, Lee, I so appreciate you sharing all your knowledge with us today. I just love it. And I do feel that you're helping so many of us become better gardeners by just understanding a little bit of the science that's going on in the garden. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Lee Reich, the author of The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. I love that interview. It just was so fascinating to me. I think I could talk to Lee all day long. So as always, I will have in the show notes for today's episode links to everything that we talked about, including all of Lee's books. And to get to the show notes, you just go to livinghomegrown.com/159. I hope you found that as interesting as I did and that you learned a little bit along the way. And just remember, don't put little pebbles in the bottom of your flower pots, okay? All right. So until next time, just try to live a little more local, seasonal, and homegrown. Take care, everybody.
That's all for this episode of the Living Homegrown Podcast. Visit livinghomegrown.com to download Teresa's free canning resource guide and find more tips on how to live farm fresh without the farm. Be sure to join Teresa Lowe next time on the Living Homegrown Podcast.